to order today. We are meeting at the quarter till the hour. We have Senators Stevens, Huggins, Stedman, and Wilkowski excused, or Senator McGuire and Senator Wagner. We have two items today. One is a great American called Representative Wilson, House Bill 176, and then we will have Dr. Williams back. Dr. Williams, thanks for coming back. I understand that you just got home on Sunday and came back on Monday, but anyway, got feed the bird, right?
Right.
Yeah, good for us. And then, of course, we have tonight, for those that are going to Penwar reception, so we're going to try to, you know, compress things to some degree. And we previously heard your bill, but Representative Wilson, if you would come forward, please.
Thank you.
And this is a 58-acre park, is that correct? State park.
Well, we want it to be a state park.
Right.
Historical.
That's your wish.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you putting us up here. And I would like to make the comment that Mike Eberhardt from DNR, who with Southeast Park Superintendent, even though this is a holiday, he came out for this bill, and I really appreciate it. Not only is it a holiday, but it's also his wife's birthday. So he's doing double duty today to us, and I really appreciate that.
Very good. Very good. Maybe if the camera could turn to Mr. Eberhardt and he could wish his wife a happy birthday, it would probably help all of us. Can you turn the camera around there, camera lady? There you go.
I'm going to get in trouble for this, but happy birthday, Pammy. I love you very much.
Well done. Okay, and in addition, we have, I think, Ms. Campbell, Ms. Lyons, and Mr. Dunlap are online. And we may or may not have to hear from them, because I think most, unless according to how much refreshing we have to do.
And that's up to you.
Yep.
I'll be glad to go into some detail. I didn't know how much refreshing you needed, and I
give us an overview, and we'll see what questions we have. I talked to Senator Stedman earlier, and he's very supportive. And of course, he's obviously up to speed on it. So,
okay. Well, in the build-up for World War II, the Department of Army constructed fortifications in several locations in the Sitka Sound, and 8,000 foot rock and gravel road was built connecting islands for protection. For Sitka, and west of the Navy seaplane and the operating bases in Sitka, and this causeway terminated at the Army's command headquarters named Fort Russo on one of the islands. So there are ruins today that there's a lot of identifiable areas that are still standing. So some of the concrete structures built by the military are still in fair condition, and they include a tri-level command post, an anti-aircraft gun battery, three ammo magazines, and two bunkers. And construction of the Sitka Airport in the late 60s eliminated pedestrian and vehicle access to that causeway. And most of the land belongs to the state of Alaska. It remained under management by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and as part of the Sitka Airport. This management is being transferred back to the Alaska Department of Natural Resources and would ultimately be managed by the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. Resources would ultimately be managed by the department, similar to Sitka's other two small urban historic state park units, Old Sitka and Castle Hill. So the proposed Fort Russo Causeway State Historical Park is small, and like you mentioned, it's 58-acre land upland area with a sliver of tidelands large enough for the footprint of a dock. And it is consistent with the purpose behind the establishment of parks, and in part it promotes the growth and development and provides opportunities and enjoyment for the citizens of Sitka as well as visitors. And along with that, the history of this is to bridge the past with the present. And the causeway has been added to the National Register of Historical Places and is designated as a historical landmark by the National Park Service. So So preservation of these unique historical features of the Fort Russo area will remind all visitors about Alaska's role in World War II and for a glimpse of life of the soldiers who stood ready to defend their country.
Very good. And is the fiscal note is still applicable at 16.8?
No, well, we have an updated one that because every year it changes, and we do have an updated one. Is this?
And it's 18.1.
18.1 million. Or thousand. Thousand, sorry.
18,000.
I have that. I apologize. We have that. Thank you.
Okay.
Questions of committee members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
Any plans, Representative Wilson, to have explanations out there, placards that would tell you the history of World War II in Sitka, and also Russo's very important role in the transfer of Alaska to the United States from Russia?
There's definite plans to do all of that. They're going to have tours for visitors as they come to Sitka. They plan to eventually feel like that it will be able to maintain itself after it gets going. So that the plans, the business plan is a very good one.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I told Representative Wilson I would ask her the question, who is this man named Russo?
I will let my Chief of Staff, Cliff Stone, answer that question.
Well, and funny you should ask that question, Senator. You enlightened the committee last year, and I did a little more research on that. Lovell H. Russo was a brigadier general, and he, in fact, was commissioned by the President of the United States to accept Alaska on behalf of our great country. So he certainly has a place in history that, until this bill, I did not know who that individual was. Although my last visit to Castle Hill, there was one of those static displays, and there was his name as bright as day. And I had read that plaque probably four or five times before, but it never stood out. And there I saw it in black and white, Russo. So thank you for sharing that.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a couple other brief notes, I think when the community has looked at this particular site, Sitka was targeted by the Japanese as the next invasion point in Alaska. And they were in the process, the U.S. military, of building gun emplacements along the causeway on Kruzoff Island. They were building a military base, and they had a radar station up and back in town on Harbor Mountain. We were growing up, we thought it was gun emplacements, but it was actually a secret radar site.
Wow.
So the concept here is not only to tie in the transfer heritage into the military orientation of the park, but also to enhance some of the wildlife viewing that's marine based during the summer with the visitors, so they have a spot where they can disembark for an hour or so and tour, because we get a lot in the community. So you get a lot of tourists and visitors that come in that want to look at the military history that Sitka has to offer also. So you know, there's several different interesting arenas that are attracting people to Fort Russo. Now, it is true that the airport has blocked most foot traffic to that site for 40-some-odd years, so there's still some things left there that have been relatively untouched for quite some time, because it's hard to get to. You have to take your skiff on a nice day and around the airport. And there was discussions on how to get people safely in and out of the park. Also, it's viewed as having the potential of being a general fund revenue maker versus a draw, which most of the parks are a draw around southeast. So this may be hopefully one of the financial keystones of the State Park Service in Southeast when it's completed.
Is there a lighting factor to it? Is it lit at night? Is there a plan? And I say that because 50% of the time when I've tried to come to Juneau, I've ended up in Sitka. It's about 11 o'clock at night. I like to go by and visit this place. So.
I don't know the answer to that, but some of the testifiers online will be able to answer it, I'm sure.
All Yeah, no, it's fine. I was actually making light of it. But it is a very beautiful community. I've only seen it at night here in the last few years. Further questions or comments from committee members? Do we have a motion?
I'd like to go ahead and move, Mr. Chairman, that we pass out of committee CS for House Bill Number 176, Resources, to the next committee referral with individual recommendations and comments.
And attached physical note.
Attached physical note.
Yeah, very good. Are there objections? Seeing none, House Bill 176 will be moved to committee. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And for those people that are online, Ms. Campbell, Ms. Lyons, and Mr. Dunlap, thank you very much. Mike, have a good birthday party. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And we'll just take about a 30-second break here for Mr. Williams to come forward. And welcome Senator Green. And with that, Mr. Williams, if you'd put yourself on the record and we can continue.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For the record, my name is Michael Williams and I'm the Chief Economist for the Department of Revenue and the Technology Works. My purpose today is to provide you with some background information on natural gas. And to lead off, I'm actually going to read some text out of a publication that was created by the International Energy Agency last year. It's called Natural Gas Market Review 2007. This is a high overview. Natural gas is becoming an increasingly global commodity. Developments in previously separate regional gas markets can no longer be considered in isolation. To 2015, investment is a more serious concern than identified in earlier work. North America is preparing to import LNG from both Pacific and Atlantic producers, while Pacific consumers have sharply increased LNG imports from Atlantic markets. LNG production capacity is growing from 240 billion cubic meters in 2005 to a projected 360 in 2010. That's a 50% increase. But capacity increases after 2010 to 2012 depend critically on new projects being sanctioned. And very soon, I might add. LNG importers in the Pacific and European regions remain able to outbid the U.S. in order to secure incremental supplies, due primarily to differences in domestic market structure. The U.S. price, usually indicated by the Henry Hub price, therefore seems to be setting a floor price for price-sensitive LNG. Investment in the gas sector is a serious cause for concern. Gas investments everywhere are suffering higher costs and construction delays. A selection of these LNG projects shows production delays averaging almost a year, with average cost overruns of more than $2 billion per project. Furthermore, only one major new LNG liquefaction project has been sanctioned in more than a year and a half, a marked slowdown compared to previous years. Reports pointing towards the formation of a gas producers association analogous to the Organization for Petroleum Exporting Countries will do little to improve this situation. The global demand for raw materials and talent has pushed up costs dramatically in some cases and reduced the effectiveness of each investment dollar spent compared to the situation reported last year. There's a distinct deficit of new long-distance pipeline investment in the period to 2015, noting that investments in transportation over increasing distances show a distinct preference for LNG. Regulatory uncertainty and NIMBY, which is an acronym for not in my backyard issues, continue to slow investment in downstream pipeline and other infrastructure, especially when borders must be crossed. Now today I'm going to divide my presentation into two distinct parts. One is the world market. I'm going to try and give you an overview, and then I'm going to focus in on North America and focus on the markets here in North America. Some key points. As I go through my presentation, you're going to see a lot of charts and data. And I actually have data from Baker Hughes, BP, SETIGAS, ENI, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the International Energy Agency, Reuters, U.S. Department of Energy, Wood Mackenzie's. I've tried to footnote all my charts at the bottom on the far right. You'll see the source. Also, I have forecasts from four organizations, the International Energy Agency. I just read part of that. SETIGAS, which is a natural gas association located in Paris, the U.S. Department of Energy, and Wood Mackenzie. In their forecast, they often have similar but different assumptions. I do not endorse any one forecast. If you actually were to read all of them, you'd see their common trends. And so what I'm going to try and get you to do is look at the trends, what's been happening in the past, and where are we going in the future. I think that'll help you as you go through the AGEA process to get a sense of what the market is like and what's going to happen. Everything changes over time. That's really important for you to understand. And the natural gas markets are really dynamic, and they're changing now. And I'm going to try and touch on some of those things. So let's start off with the world view. And as I go through this part, I'm going to cover six areas: reserves, worldwide reserves, production, consumption, transportation, prices, and an outlook. Now here's natural gas reserves, and I'm going to start off by just helping you understand the chart. The vertical axis is in trillions of cubic meters. The horizontal axis is time. You'll notice it runs from 2000 to 2007. In this chart, we've seen reserves go from about 156 billion to over 181 billion in this seven-year period. That's 16% increase. So reserves are not static. These colors down here match up with the country, so you'll see Russia has the largest reserves, followed by Iran, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. In fact, Russia and Iran have about 46% of the world's proven reserves. The U.S. share is about 3.2%, and Alaska is well under 1%. There's natural gas production. Production increased almost 18% between 2000 and 2006. Russia and the U.S. are the two largest producers. Russia's got about a 22% share, and the U.S. about 15. What's interesting is Iran, which is this area in the middle here, had the fastest growth, and you can see how thin it is from there to there. It grew about 67% in this time period. Consumption. It increased over the years, and I forgot to write down the percentage, but it appears it was about 3% per year. And the U.S. is the largest consumer. It's at the bottom of the chart, about 22%. Russia is second with about 15%. Now, there's disparities between producers and consumers. That is to say, over time, countries that are consuming don't have enough, so they have to import it. And so that's what leads to trade. Now, this chart comes from ENI, and it's not 2000 to 2006.
Yeah, Mr. Williams.
Certainly.
If you go quickly back to your other chart, and just for the question of China and India are often discussed when it comes to natural resources, in this case natural gas. Where do they fall in this, if you have the data?
I can look real quickly. I've got a page photocopied. And it's tiny print from the BP review. And China this is consumption, right? They're about 45 billion billion cubic meters. They would definitely be in the all other category, and they're one of the larger other categories. And I'm trying to see, they're on the same scale as Uzbekistan, the Netherlands.
Well, they're primarily a coal consumer, as I recall, but
that's correct. Primarily coal,
but they have interest in natural gas, hence the Sinopec bid, I would suppose.
Yes, and apart from that, China has also signed contracts with Shell to develop integrated gasification combined cycle. And one of the 8 studies that was undertaken about fuel generation in the world included one of those plants that was in China. So they have made a foray into natural gas. A few years ago, I thought they were going to be a big player. When prices went up, they seemed to have backed off. They seem to be going in and back into it again. I don't know how that's going to play out.
Okay, thank you.
Certainly.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just on the natural gas reserves, unless my math is wrong, I'm looking back at the DNR presentation, I thought Alaska alone had about 34.5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas known reserves. It doesn't seem to mesh with what you have here for USA.
Remember Mr. Banks talked about what's proven reserves? What's proven reserves is basically what's on the book when you file with the SEC. If you were to go to the U.S. Department of Energy and look at reserves for the United States, you'd see they're, I'm sorry, for Alaska, you'd see they're on the order of 9 to 10 billion.
Or it's a definition.
9 to 10 trillion cubic feet. Right. So it's a definitional issue.
He's got this one slide in the prior presentation, which is known reserves, and you're saying that's different than SEC reserves.
That's different from proven reserves. Proven reserves, according to the SEC, is a little bit narrower. You actually have to have contracts in place.
All right. Thank you.
Proceed.
I was just about to talk about trade. This chart covers 10 years, and there's several things I'd like you to take away from it. First of all, the vertical axis is not in cubic meters, it's actually in a percent. And so what we're looking at is the total percent of production that's being exported. And what you realize when you actually study the numbers is that exports are increasing faster than production. That means more nations are beginning to export. And this dark area is pipeline, and this reddish area, or this dark area down here, is LNG. And the export share is now standing at 30%. And in 1995, it was up about 22.5%. So while production has increased 3% per year, exports have been increasing in excess of 7% per year. And LNG is the fastest growing. In other words, it's been growing faster than pipeline has, and it's been growing at about 10% per year.
Now, Mr. Williams, very quickly, would you give us a thumbnail sketch of construction of LNG plants or regasification plants in the U.S. recently, last 5 years?
You mean the plants that have been approved?
Yeah, one that's done, that's operating.
The ones that are operating, there's actually 6 of them, and one of them is not on land. It's in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's actually in your, it's one of the slides, and I'm looking for it
okay,
right
that's
now.
Fine. If, it's a, if you're going to cover it, that's fine.
Okay.
Get to it. That's good.
I'll move on then. Now, one of the things I'd like you to see is how gas actually moves around the world. And it's difficult to see on this chart, but you can see it in the paper. These red bars represent natural gas and pipelines, and the blue bars represent LNG. And so there's actually several markets here. You can see there's the Asia market over here. We've got this North Atlantic market, which is right in there. And then within that, you've got the European market. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the movement of cargoes and how some of the cargoes have started off for the United States and been diverted eventually to Asia because there was a better price in Asia. But this gives you an idea of what the actual trade routes are. The next thing I'd like to talk about is prices. Prices are not constant. That's one thing you can see from this chart. Vertical axis has the price in U.S. dollars per million BTU. The horizontal axis is monthly data. And we've got three sets of prices here. German pipeline, which is this dashed line in green. Japanese LNG, which is this red. And then the solid blue is the Henry Hub price. Several things stand out. First of all, U.S. prices are far more volatile than either German or LNG prices. In part, that's because of the isolation that the U.S. market has had from the rest of the world. We don't import much LNG. And we go back to what I said earlier in my little introduction. That is fading. That is changing. Second thing you can see is that there's a stronger correlation between the LNG and the pipeline prices than there is between either one of those and the U.S. prices. In fact, it's about 97%. So when price goes up in one, the other goes up almost the same amount. Now, the U.S. relationship to the other is much looser. It's positive, but about 0.6. So it's a much looser relationship. And as we think in terms of gas prices, we think of prices, you know, on an energy equivalent basis, and we want to compare that to oil and see how it changes. And here we've got Japanese crude and LNG. And you'll notice this starts in 1969, so these are average annual prices, and it goes through 2005. It's actually into 2006. Now, again, it's difficult to tell it on this chart because the colors don't show up real well on the screen, but this darker line is black, and that's the LNG price. The lighter line is the crude price, and crude here is JCC, and that's Japanese crude cocktail, which is the average price for all the crude oils imported into Japan. And the Japanese LNG price is the average price for all LNG imported into Japan. Now, for starting in about here in the mid-80s after oil prices crashed, you'll notice that LNG prices were pretty much higher than crude prices. And starting around in here, 2002, crude prices have been higher than LNG prices. In the period around 2002 to 2004, a lot of the contracts were renegotiated. And at that time, what they said was, when crude prices go up, LNG prices will only go up 85% of what the crude prices went up. And so that's why you see this large differential up here at the top. So that's something that has the potential to shrink as crude prices come down if the same formula remains in place. Will they change the contracts in the future? I don't know.
Yeah, you said they. Do you agree with that theory economically?
What? Which one?
The relationship that you were describing coming down with crude prices.
Both prices may come down.
Okay.
Prices go up and prices come down. I believe very strongly that there will be a correction. And I'm not going to say when. I'm not going to get into that.
Okay.
But I believe prices matter, and I'll talk about that in a little bit as well.
Nice try.
Yeah.
I know there are some people that don't think prices are going to come down, but I feel very strongly about that. Now, there's two things I'd like to talk about with LNG contracts. One is the looser linkage to crude oil, and I'm also going to talk about spot cargoes. And I'm going to read a little bit from this IEA study, because they've got a nice description. Traditional LNG projects were underpinned by long-term sales and purchase contracts with consuming markets. However, more recent projects have been sanctioned with upstream stakeholders purchasing planned output and in turn marketing by themselves, either through capacity and/or equity acquisition at regasification terminals in consuming countries, or even direct sales to willing buyers. Those companies with regasification capacities in multiple consuming regions are also making FOB, which is free on board, offtake commitments to fill those capacities or to sell a higher paying market in a more flexible approach than previously seen. What this means is that 15 years ago, you had a contract to sell your LNG and you sold all of it in one market. Boom, that was that. Over time, that's changed. They debottlenecked the plants. They had extra cargoes. As price differentials started creeping up, they started selling extra cargoes to different markets, not just under the contract. Under the newer contracts, they actually specify that you don't have to sell all the cargo to the one market. You can diversify. That's actually a very big deal. It's the beginnings of the, shall we say, a global market for gas. For the first time in the history, as much as 6% of the Atlantic region, remember the Atlantic regions I pointed out, LNG production, or 4.8 billion cubic meters, was diverted into the Asian market in 2006. Now I'm going to switch here quickly to Middle East Economic Survey. This is November 19th, 2007, and the byline says, LNG market evolution to bring producers growing offtake diversity. The LNG market is undergoing fundamental changes. Keep that in mind as you go through AGEA. There's fundamental changes going on in the world. LNG's flexibility, it's something that a pipeline does not have, promises to drive the globalization of gas markets. The short-term and spot market accounted for about 16% of trade in 2000, 16% compared to under 4% 10 years ago. So this is an accelerating trend. This is not something that's creeping along. November 22nd, the Economic Times, and out of Singapore, the DuPai Multi-Commodity Center, the DMCC, is planning to launch a liquefied natural gas futures contract on its exchange soon as surging energy prices increase demand for hedging tools, its chief executive officer said. With a storage hub in place, we are in good shape to launch the contract. DMC, along with the company in Dubai, is setting up a 40 to 65 billion cubic foot LNG storage facility at a cost of about $2 billion to offer customers the ability to store and trade the product. Now, I don't know when all of this is going to be active. The sort of things you're seeing with WTI, the New York Mercantile Exchange, I suspect within 2 years we're going to be seeing that in natural gas. It's not possible. It's already occurred. I mean, Gutter has paid $200 million to set up the exchange.
Yes, Senator Stevens?
Would you say that again? What are the fundamental changes you're talking about in the LNG market?
It's no longer one seller and one buyer. It's no longer one producer and one consumer. The producer now has the option to sell its cargoes in more than one market. Now, when you have major projects like that and you go out for project finance, in order to get project finance, you actually have to show that you've got contracts in place to purchase the gas. And so that's the way all the initial projects were structured, because of project finance. All the output went to one place. But over time, as more producers have come on and there's been more regasification facilities built around the world, companies are being able to expand their production and send extra to the new markets, if you would, the new regas facilities. It's a very big deal. And the fact that we're going to have spot trading in it is also a very big deal.
So, Mr. Chairman, what you're saying then is that it would be large storage areas, and then buyers would come to that storage area and buy from that without having a prior commitment.
Exactly.
So does that mean the market would be more volatile than I'd assume, right?
Be more volatile. Now, that's a good question. I often believe that the financial sector doesn't create the trends, they amplify the trends. Now, would it be more volatile? I don't know. I mean, I haven't studied that this much, but, you know, my gut feeling is yes, but I don't know that.
Very interesting. Thank you.
What I think I hear you saying is LNG gives more flexibility.
Absolutely.
All things being considered, all things equal, better off going LNG than a fixed pipeline. Is that fair to say?
For a producer, it might be. Might very well be.
Well, how about for Alaska? I mean, have you looked at this? We're going to have to make a big decision here about whether or not we want a fixed route going through Canada back to down to Calgary, or thousands of miles long, or whether or not potentially we want a line where we're going to do an LNG down to Valdez.
You're getting into some things that are really difficult. You're putting me on the spot, Senator.
And I don't mean to put you on the spot. I'm just...
But I mean, one has to look at all options. And one of the things about a pipeline that would head into Canada, go east, so to say, east and south, is that you wouldn't have both the liquefaction cost plus the pipeline cost. I mean, it's something to keep in mind. When you look at Qatar, when you look at Australia, when you look at a lot of the places that are exporting gas and exporting a lot of gas, the facilities are sitting on top of the gas reserves. Liquefaction in this state would occur on the water's edge, right? But you have to get the gas to that point. So there is a difference. And so while LNG may offer more flexibility, and I agree with you on that, it's not the only factor you have to take into account, and costs are important.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
So, Mr. Williams, sounds like more short-term commitments or potential contracts or the sort of the wave as we're going forward, shorter-term contracts?
At least for, well, I wouldn't say short-term. Okay. They're still long-term, but they're not tying up the entire production volumes.
Right.
They're giving them more flexibility.
Okay. Okay. Good. Thanks. Continue.
Where am I here? Okay. Now, I showed you how crude and natural gas prices had diverted in Japan. I'd like to do the same thing in the United States. And here I'm going to use WTI, West Texas Intermediate, and prices at the Henry Hub. On the vertical axis, we've got prices on the left in dollars per million BTU, and in the right, we've got prices in dollars per barrel. On the horizontal axis, we've got monthly data starting in January 1986 and running to, I think this is December 2007. The solid line are WTI prices, and the dotted line are the average wellhead price of natural gas. And overall, the correlation coefficient is about 0.87 for that entire period. And what that means is when one goes up, the other goes up. When, you know, one comes down, the other comes down. But hark, look at the far right. They start going apart. Now, what's going on here? What I want to do is actually blow up this period starting in about August 2005 so you can see it in more detail. So what I do is I switch to daily data, the same two series, and what you can see is several things. First of all, gas prices actually drop below oil prices, and then they tend to go up and down, while oil prices tend to go up. So there's not a strong relationship. In fact, if you look at the correlation coefficient, not only does it switch signs, it used to be positive 0.87, but it goes negative and it's almost zero, so there's virtually no relationship. And one of the things that's important here is to think in terms of the ratio of one price to the other. So if you converted both of these to dollars per million BTU and then divided one by the other, you'd see that the ratio has changed. Now, when you think in terms of energy equivalency, you think in terms of about 6 to 1, you know, gas to oil, and which is down in here. And what you see from this chart, it has changed rather dramatically. And up here it was about 18, and now we're in the range of 14. Now I want to go back to what Marcia Davis was talking about yesterday when she was talking about how the price of natural gas brings down the average value, so it provides a benefit to an oil and gas producer, right? It reduces the value per unit of barrel oil equivalent. So are we going to remain at this level? That's a rhetorical question for all of you to think about. I don't have the answer to that, but it's something to consider. Is this a temporary phenomenon? Temporary, I mean, think in terms of 50 years. Is this something that's going to last for another 2 years and then go back to historical? I don't know. It's something I've been monitoring when I first noticed it in 2006, and it doesn't seem to have changed, so I don't know what's happening. I wish I could offer more insights.
Mr. Stedman?
Dr. Williams, if oil becomes more scarce than gas, because there's been testimony here at the table over the last couple of years that the world is basically getting awash in natural gas. There's been a lot of publications the last couple of years of Saudi Arabia possibly peaking their oil production, and I don't know if that's true or not true, but there is some concern in some articles that we may be on the decline in oil. And if that direction is true, wouldn't that not put more pressure to value oil higher than gas?
I don't think that's the driving factor, actually. Personally, I think it's the fact that what's driving oil prices is transportation. There's not a ready substitute for oil. Natural gas does have substitutes.
Okay.
Notice how I dodged the bullet about talking about Saudi Arabia?
Yes. Mr. Williams, on the other hand, as I recall, we import the majority of our crude from Canada. Is that correct?
I think that's correct.
Right.
Canada and, yes, we also
get a bit from
the good
news is they have the number two known reserves in the world, in the tar sands.
Exactly. By the way, that plays into, we're eventually going to talk about Canadian gas coming in, and those tar sands will play into that. Now, I'd like to present an outlook, and this is from SETI Gas. And I just want to say one thing about all the forecasts I'm going to present. I'm not favoring one forecast or another. Typically, when I put them on a chart, it's because they're easy to read. But the trends that you'll see in this are very similar to those you'd see in the U.S. Department of Energy or Wood Mackenzie. I like this chart because it breaks out the world by regions, and you can see the supply and the demand and also the gap. If we start down at the bottom in the world total, you'll see that SETI Gas out to 2015 is showing gas use increasing at about 2%, 2.2% per year. And again, that's pretty typical of what you'd see if you'd look at a number of forecasts. If we go up to North America, you'll see that we actually have supply almost flat. It increases 0.3 while demand increases. And of course, the ramifications of that is that we actually import more. And so how is that going to occur? I mean, that's the issue there. So my synopsis for the world overview, gas growth will continue. We'll likely see more LNG. The spot market for LNG will be developing. And gas and oil prices delinked. And I should have put a question mark after that because it is now. But will it be in the future? I don't know. I'd like to move on to the North American market, unless there are more questions on this.
Senator Stedman?
No, Dr. Williams, wouldn't it be just a natural trend as the gas industry developed and they started doing more LNGs and the industry started making larger and larger tankers and more that which creates, you know, or is pulled by more global trade that it would be natural evolution to have a spot market price, which you were talking about earlier, dealing with some of these global trade issues. So isn't this just a natural evolution of a marketplace that's getting bigger and more fluid? And
yes, exactly. Trade? It is. And in fact, the tankers have been getting bigger. Mm-hmm. And some of the issues surrounding that are they can't get into the ports. And just so you know, those are some of the issues. Mm-hmm. I'll move on to North America then. I'm going to deal with demand and some issues and also supply. And I've got issues in the middle because you'll see them at the beginning and the end. But there's definitely some things I want you to know about. Let's start off with demand. There's four major sectors and then one minor sector. There's the industrial sector. Think here in terms of petrochemical plants. They use gas for feedstock as well as to generate energy. Think of residential. This is heating, cooking, those sorts of things, electric power. Think in terms of generating electricity and commercial, that's primarily heating. And then there's all these other uses, lease plant, pipelines, and minuscule amounts for transportation. As I mentioned earlier, I want you to think about trends. And historically, the trends that are important in North America is that the industrial sector was the largest sector. And the electricity sector has been the fastest growing sector over the last 15 or 20 years. That's because of combined cycle electric generating using gas, its efficiency is in excess of 50%, and I'm not an engineer. I can only tell you that it's very efficient, so they've started moving towards it. As we look forward, though, and I'm going to go into this in a little bit more detail, what we have to realize is that the industrial sector is not competitive. If we just look at the petrochemical industry in this country, it's lost market share over the last 15, 20 years, and employment in that sector is down 33% since 1990. So the industrial sector is not competitive, petrochemicals. Electricity, while there will continue to be growth, it's reduced growth.
Excuse me, Mr. Williams, would you mention some of the petrochemical kind of subunits, example, fertilizer, and but some items like that that are drifting away, cement?
Polypropylene is probably one of the big things that comes out of that. You get all sorts of fertilizers that are used in food products. There's a number of things. I'm drawing a blank right now, but I assure you there's a wide array of products.
Right. It's all going overseas.
But the largest new petrochemical plants being built are overseas in the Middle East. Right. And in fact, I've got a chart that shows you just the average size of the petrochemical plants.
It turns out to not be cost effective here based on price of gas and demand. Is that true or false?
There's a couple of things. One is the price, and I'm not sure how much of a factor that is because I haven't seen any of the contracts. Everything I've seen with regard to the Middle East is dated. I believe the prices are lower, but they have guaranteed supplies. That's another topic I'm going to get into shortly. And then the SABIC, for instance, in Saudi Arabia, the government petrochemical branch actually has contracts with private companies. So they do offer them incentives. They set up industrial centers like at Yanbu, and everything is really state-of-the-art. They're brand new.
And Agria is a good example. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Do you have any data on geographical trends in North America? And trying to relate this to Alaska again. Trends perhaps on the West Coast where an LNG might be shipped versus trends in the Midwest where a line to Calgary would be used as a distribution point.
I've got a map which I'll show you which has all the LNG plants in operation plus all the proposed plants. And with me I've got something that's not going to be shown, but I'll be delighted to give it to you afterwards, which is a map which actually has all the pipelines in North America plus all the natural gas pipelines plus all of the LNG plants. So that gives, but this doesn't have anything proposed. This is historical. I can give you this. I haven't put together all the proposed natural gas pipelines, but you will see the proposed LNG facilities that get right off the FERC, and it's in one of my slides here.
Yeah, the bad news is it appears that most people predicted that the supermajority of the LNG plants will not be built at the sites proposed for lots of reasons, is the word I've had. Is it you concurred or not with that?
I've heard that there's a lot of not in my backyard feeling, right. And so people right. Don't want them. And the oil industry and its ingenuity and its creativity has developed regasification facilities that float offshore, and then you put in a floating pipeline and you can bring the natural gas in gaseous form. So even that obstacle has been overcome. And in fact, in the Gulf of Mexico, they now have one of those platforms. I think Accelerate is the name of the company that designed and implemented that. And that went into operation, I think, in 2006. I'm not sure.
But then we run into Hurricane Alley. But go ahead, please.
Now, this is an old chart. I'm embarrassed to say, but I put this together some time ago. But for the short amount of time, I wanted you to see things. What's important for you to understand is that the actual data isn't that different from what I'm showing here. On the this is natural gas demand in the United States. Trillions of cubic feet is the vertical axis. Horizontal axis is time. It starts at 1997 and goes out to 2015. I think one of the most important things to see about this is the total demand. And if you look up at the top, it varies between 20 and 25, and it's not till you get out to 2015 that it actually gets above that 25 trillion cubic feet line in this forecast. And even if you looked at the most recent forecast, it's about the same level. 2005, you'll notice it actually went down, and in part that was due to what happened in the Gulf of Mexico, the hurricanes. Not only did they reduce the supply of oil and gas, but they reduced the demand because there's a lot of petrochemical plants down there and a lot of refineries. So they went down, so they weren't consuming. You'll notice that this dark bar down at the bottom is the industrial. Notice how it comes down again. It's in decline. It loses share over time. Electricity generation is this orangish part in the middle, and it's the one that's growing. It's the growth share. Now, another way of presenting this is in a pie chart. So I've done 2005 and 2008, and you'll see that together the electric sector and the industrial sector account for about 60%, I think it's 56-58%, depends on the year, of total demand in the United States. And this is actually a very big deal. One is not growing, and the other is growing.
Could you differentiate in your pie chart between the commercial and industrial?
Commercial?
Yeah.
Industrial is down here, this dark part,
right.
And commercial is right next to it. So industrial, think in terms of heavy industries. Like I said, petrochemical plants or cement plants, things like that.
Right.
Commercial, think in terms of the large buildings that house offices, software companies, things like that. That's commercial centers.
Yeah. So, okay, I understand. Got it. Yeah.
It's the difference between heavy industry and, you know, white collar work, so to say.
The residential, commercial, and industrial are all down slightly. Where is that going? Is that another source supplying the energy, or is that conservation?
I can't answer that. I do know that fuel efficiency is a big deal. I also know that, and this is anecdotal evidence, I haven't seen any studies on this, but if you own a house and the house is old, at some point you have to start thinking in terms of replacing things, the roof, windows, heaters. And with some of the problems that occurred in 2005, people have started switching out gas. Again, this is anecdotal. I haven't seen any studies to know what portion or how severe that is. And I'd actually have to get back on you. But I believe there is some substitution going on. I just can't speak to it in any sort of quantitative way. I will say that think in terms of trends. The events that occurred in 2005 with the hurricane go far beyond price, and you have to think about that as a consumer, whether you're an electric utility plant, an industrial plant, or someone who heats their home. Do you want to have gas? You know, even if you have offshore regas facilities, you know, it's possible it could get wiped out in a hurricane. Is flexibility always the best thing? Gets back to your earlier question. There is value in pipelines sometimes. They are there. You have to look at the big picture. Another way of presenting change here, and up at the or in the middle, you notice I've got different color boxes, and they represent different eras, 97 to 2000, 2000 to 5, 5 to 10, and 10 to 15. On the vertical axis, we've got percentages, and these are average annual changes. So it's the average change in a year. And if we look at the period 2000 to 2005, which is the green, you'll notice in total it's down, others down, residential's down, commercial's down, industrial's down big time. Why is that? Those were the reductions associated with the Hurricane Katrina. And remember, we've got, I think, 3/4 of the refineries and a significant portion of our petrochemical plant located in that part of the country. So when that occurred, they stopped functioning. And you'll notice also that 2005 to 10 is up. Part of that is due to the fact that the industries that went down for 6 months started coming back. And now most of them are in operation again. So part of that is just coming back from the hurricane. But you'll notice there is growth in the 2000 to 2015. this shows it at about 1%. Remember, I talked about the difference in forecasts. City Gas had it about 1.3%. So very similar here, very similar between forecasts.
This is gas, not forms of energy.
Right, this is just gas.
Senator Wilkowski.
If we look long-term, because I'm just kind of curious about, you know, where why those sectors are decreasing in natural gas use. I mean, you don't see more coal plants in the U.S. I would think that oil, because the price is high, would be relatively diminished. You don't see nuclear plants being built. So I'm just curious about it. And maybe that's a discussion that we can have down the line. But I guess, obviously, for Alaska, we're concerned about how much natural gas is going to be used in the next 30 years. It seemed to me it's clean, it's relatively cheap, so it seems intuitively that it would be on the increase. Am I wrong there? Or
those are some of the uncertainties I'm going to leave you to ponder when I depart today. But I will say this, there's spare electricity generating capacity using natural gas right now. It's the most expensive of fossil fuels. And so they use it for peaking. So when you've got a peak period, you fire up the gas thing. You can build them in small sizes. You can site them wherever you want. They're easy to bring up and take down. You asked about the long term. Because of some of the issues surrounding Hurricane Katrina, because of the high cost on a per million BTU basis, I'm going to show you all of these things for North America. Companies, utilities, are beginning to consider other options. Later in my presentation, I will point out that two nuclear plants have been proposed to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in September of 2007. Now, that may not seem like much, but that was the first two plants proposed in 31 years. In Texas, after the hurricanes, the utilities down there proposed something like 15 or 20 integrated gasification combined cycle coal plants. The environmentalists did not like that, so they withdrew that, and I think they proposed 5 or 6 and a nuclear plant. So long term, the decisions haven't been made. We're at a stage right now where utilities are beginning to make those decisions, and that is something I'm going to touch on because I think it's a very big deal. So what are some of the issues here? I just touched on some of them, but I want to review them. There'll be regulations, hurricanes, international competition, price effects, and legislation. And I just like to go through these one at a time, and I've already touched on them, so at least you know what my perspective is. And first thing I'm going to do is talk about natural gas regulation, and please don't go to sleep during this part because it's very important. In this country, regulation began in 1938, deregulation began in 1978, that's 40 years after regulation, and another 18 years after that, deregulation was complete. I want you to think of that. That means natural gas was regulated for almost 60 years in this country. And notice my issues are infrastructure and cheap natural gas. Now let's take a look at natural gas prices at the wellhead from 1930 to 2006. And you'll see they're relatively flat down here from 38 to about 72, 73. Now, I want you to think in terms of building your home or constructing a company. The government was regulating prices. Guess what? Gas was cheap. So you built your plant using gas. You know it was going to be cheap. The government regulated it, right? What happened in 73? There were some major things that happened in the world, and oil prices quadrupled. At the same time, gas prices started going up. And guess what? For the first time in years, those industries had to deal with higher natural gas prices. A lot of companies actually went out of business in the 80s because of the cost. They could no longer compete internationally. Because prices of oil went higher, you know, they could actually drill for oil, but gas was constrained. There was a lot of issues with that. And so towards the end of the mid-70s, there started to be a supply crunch in the United States. And there wasn't enough natural gas. And that's what prompted the 1978, I think it was Natural Gas Policy Act. And what they started doing was saying if you were such an, if a well was a certain age, they could charge a certain price, but the newer wells could charge a higher price because the costs were higher. Well, they spent a number of years going through all of that, and eventually they deregulated it. And then take a look what happens here. Prices go up, and then we have this spike here. Remember, prices are deregulated in here somewhere. And look what happens here. This was what happened, the Enron scandal. We're regulating, or we're manipulating prices. Now, think of yourself as being that same company that was using natural gas. What are you going to do going forward? Are you going to consider using a different energy source, a different technology? Are you going to move overseas? What are you going to do? I mean, these are the issues that were set in place with regulation for 60 years. And I think you raise a very good question. You know, the demand's going to go up. Is it going to go up? I will ask you that question. If you're producing petrochemicals, would you rather produce it at half the cost in Saudi Arabia or do it here in the United States? I don't have an answer to that, because if you're producing in this country, you don't have transportation charges, you don't have to worry about all sorts of quotas and things that may pop up in the future. So it's something to consider, and I don't know what the answer is, but regulation has made a difference in this country in the use of natural gas, and its impact is still being felt. I want to talk about hurricanes for a minute. I've already alluded to this. This data comes from the Minerals Management Service down here. You'll notice the date starts in August 29, 2005 and runs through mid-December. This is hurricanes shut in natural gas volumes from Katrina, Rita, Wilma, millions of cubic feet per day. And here was production. You notice it goes down. We get another hurricane. Goes down, down, down. This interruptible supplies is probably the biggest deal, and this is a big deal to utilities. You know, electric utilities, they like to run 24/7. Their customers get angry when they go offline. If they can't get gas, they are very concerned. One of the issues for them, therefore, is having regular supplies. And it's not just price. This is part of the issue that's going on with natural gas right now. As a sidelight, there was a paper written by the U.S. Department of Energy, which I it's in my briefcase somewhere, but it was the effects of cyclones on natural gas supplies in the Gulf of Mexico. It came out last year. So, I mean, it's a very big deal, and you shouldn't think light of it. Industrial competition, this is the average ethylene plant size. This data came from Oil and Gas Journal. They do a summary at the end of each year. And here's the average plant size in the United States. It's about 200,000 tons per year. Here's Saudi Arabia. Check this out. What is that? 750,000. We're dealing with economies of scale, and I believe they also have some, shall we say, favorable prices, but I can't document that. I know they used to. I don't know what it is today. So we're talking about some serious differences in efficiencies here, and it's something that should not be underestimated. So will demand keep growing? I'm not sure. Like I said, there's benefits to staying in the country, but there's also benefits to going overseas.
Ethylene, what should we be seeing? What would we be seeing? Ethylene.
Ethylene is a product, I think, that goes into a lot of plastics. I think it's the base for it. I want to talk about the price effect. I know some of you think the prices will go up and they won't come down. I really don't believe that.
Oh, say that again.
I said some of you believe that prices will go up and not come down. And I said I don't believe that.
Okay.
I believe prices will come down.
Okay.
Since 2000, the price of natural gas has increased and is stimulating the evaluation of other fuel options. Now, I'm going to read from SETI Gas, their medium-term outlook, page 2. This is a quote now. This is an international association that just deals with natural gas. All their members produce or consume gas. We, the state of Alaska, are an associate member. I joined because I thought it was important that we understand their perspective. In recent years, however, high gas prices have stimulated competition among energies and impacted gas demand in many OECD countries. In the power sector, where substitution of one energy by another can be fairly rapid. Power producers in the United Kingdom, for instance, privileged coal, an abundant resource, which despite recent price increases, still remains cheaper entering the plant than natural gas, whose price is often indexed to oil products. The price of gas is also a serious parameter in potential demand from the industrial sector. In the United States, it is prompting the largest industrial users to turn to alternative energies, as in the past when they chose natural gas because it was cheaper. In the U.S., some U.S. firms preferred to halt production because of a profit squeeze due to the high price of gas in 2005. So there is a price effect. It does impact decision-making product, the decision-making perspective. And if you think in terms of your own personal self, would you put in a more fuel-efficient natural gas heater if prices doubled again? I mean, just think about what you might do. Would you switch to electricity? I mean, these are things I'm trying to get you to think about. Think about what Agrium's doing because they don't have enough gas to run regularly. Price makes a difference, and the interruptibilities of supplies make a difference. And I don't think you should underestimate these things. I'm going to talk a little bit about electric generation because, again, this is the fastest growing sector of gas consumption in the United States. And this is electric generation by fuel source, 2005 gross production, 4 trillion kilowatt hours. And you'll see that coal is almost half of that, okay? Gas is about 19%. I'm going to flip to the IEA, because I've got a quote in here I want to share with you. This deals with gas-fired capacity. It says, so much gas-fired capacity was built that it outstripped demand for power, and many combined cycle gas turbines are now operating at less than 35% load factor. Because of this, there is a substantial latent demand for gas in the power sector without any new investment in capital stock. This dynamic is a very important legacy of the 2000 to 2004 investment period. Gas plants do provide flexibility in electrical systems. They're relatively low capital cost, and they make it easier to gear up and down. Now, we've talked about cost for a minute, and I've got this chart, and I got this from Wood Mackenzie. And let me help you read this, first of all. Each one of the bars represents producing energy from a different method, if you would. Here's steam coal down at the bottom. This is gas combined cycle, GCC. This is a nuclear plant. This is IGCC, integrated gasification combined cycle. That means you take coal, make gas, and generate electricity. No CCS means you don't sequester the carbon. And then IGCC with carbon sequestration, okay? These are full cycle costs in dollars per megawatt hour, okay? So we're looking at the different ways of generating electricity, and we're looking at the cost. And for IGCC, we've got it with and without carbon sequestration. Now, you can't see it on this chart, and I didn't create this. I used this from Wood Mac. But this top bar up here is what it would cost if you had to remove the CO2 to meet, shall we say, the world standards for CO2. So let's just take a look. Big picture, you'll notice that the highest cost is right here. Integrated gasification combined cycle. And we're looking at about $90 per million watt hours, okay? And if we look over here at gas, we're looking at about 65, right? Somewhere between 65 and 70. You'll notice that nuclear has the lowest full cycle cost. Now, I want you to think in terms of decision making. At some point you do benefits and costs, what sort of plant you're going to have, right? Then you implement it, you spend the money, and it's all a sunk cost. So your marginal cost is the fuel cost. That's a very important part. So let's take a look at the fuel costs. And the fuel costs are those that are, that I've got listed here. These are the green bar up here. And you'll notice that out of all of these, natural gas has the highest fuel cost. Nuclear has the lowest fuel cost, but gas has the lowest capital cost. So these are the trade-offs utilities are looking at. You know, one of them has a very low capital cost, but a very high marginal cost. The nuclear plant, by contrast, you have this huge upfront capital cost, but very low marginal cost. These are the issues the utilities are looking at right now. I don't believe they've made decisions. I think it's too early to tell. Remember I said they've got extra gas capacity? They also started, they haven't completed all the gas capacity they started constructing 5 years ago. So I'm guessing somewhere between 2010 and 2015 is when, you know, crunch time is. Between now and somewhere between 2010, they're going to be making these decisions. So I believe that there's still room for any one of these options to come forward. Let me think here. I think that's all I have on this slide. Now, I showed you the differential in prices, and what I want you to see is what the average, the actual differential was. Those were full cycle costs. And these are what prices of coal are delivered to the utility versus gas. These are actuals for 2005 and 2006. So you can see there is quite a benefit, you know, to going with coal at this point. The issue is it's got the higher capital costs compared to gas. And then this just gives you a little something to think about. If you build a natural gas plant, they tend to be a little bit smaller. Here they're looking like they're about, what is this, 50 megawatts. But if you look at coal, they're about 210, 220. So if you build one coal plant, that's what, 4 or 5 gas plants. And if you build a nuclear, you're doing about 12. So if you think in terms of doing a substitute for a gas plant, it'll likely be larger. And the implications of that is it takes out a significant amount of potential demand.
Hydro expanding at all?
Not in this country. It is in the developing world. In fact, there's some trends in place, which I'm not prepared to discuss, but I'm aware of them. There's been drought in a number of regions, and with hydro, you actually can have decrease in electricity production with the same capacity in place, the same demand, but because of reduced rainfall, you can't generate as much electricity. So in periods when there's drought, that has actually gone down. In some of the rivers in the northwest part of the United States, I believe they've actually removed some of the dams due to environmental issues. So it could actually go up even though dams have come down if they get more rainfall. You know, that's one of those issues. You got to look at it at a micro level.
Senator Wilkowski.
I appreciate your looking at this from a strictly economic standpoint. And I guess if everyone was doing that, we'd have coal and nuclear plants all over the country. But I guess you have to factor in the political perspective. And from personally, I mean, we can't get a coal plant built here in Alaska. Do you see, I mean, have you analyzed, do you take that into account when you're looking at these things? I mean, realistically, are we going to have more coal plants, more coal generators? Do you foresee more nuclear generators in the country in the next 20 years? Are you able to give us your best estimate on that?
Nothing like a loaded question. I believe change is afoot. And I'm going to talk about your question. Legislation. The Energy Act of 2005 adds a dimension which is something we haven't discussed yet. Coal credits, nuclear credits, the environment. Let me read to you from the Energy Act of 2005. Section 1307 creates an investment tax credit program for qualifying advanced clean coal projects funded at $1.3 billion. This section also includes an additional $350 for qualifying gasification projects. The gasification credits for any taxable year is equal to 20% of the basis of any equipment to be used in the gasification process that is placed in service during the year as part of a gasification project that has been certified by DOE. Section 411 authorized a loan guarantee for a coal project in the Upper Great Plains, which must employ both renewable and advanced IGCC technologies. Section 413 authorized a cost-sharing program in support of high-altitude, at least 4,000 feet, Western IGC demonstration projects. Finally, a loan guarantee for an IGC plant located in a deregulation region was authorized in Section 14. Nuclear energy provisions. Section 1306 of Title 13 extends the PTC of 1.8 cents per kilowatt hour, not adjusted for inflation, to any nuclear power plant with a new design that has a construction start date before January 2014 and enters commercial operation in January 1st, 2021. Apart from the economic things that I've been discussing, what I'm trying to point out is that the federal government of the United States is actually offering tax credits and incentives at this point. It's no one thing, you know, and that's the point I'm trying to make. I don't know. I have my own belief system, but, you know, how will it play out? We haven't talked about the third bullet yet. Environment. Environment, you know, when I think about some of the big debates right now, it's, you know, global warming, carbon emissions, those sorts of things. What will happen in that arena? Will they outlaw coal? I mean, for example, will they do that? It's an option. When you look at carbon emissions and you talk to environmentalists, you find out that some of them actually have positive thoughts about the nuclear community. Why? Because there's no carbon emissions associated with it. Senator, I wish I could answer your question and say, oh, we're going to have one of these and two of those. But really, I don't know. It's a moving target. You know, energy security is another thing to consider. The United States government often makes claims about wanting to become more energy independent. I think you probably heard that terminology. And that plays into this as well. The thing I want you to see is that it's not crystal clear. There's enough confusion here for everybody, and I really don't know how it's going to play out. But I can certainly see the factors which could influence the construction of a nuclear plant in the next 15 years, and I could certainly see the implementation of some integrated gasification combined cycle coal plants. So I wouldn't rule them out if I were you.
And if I might, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Texas is the test site for sequestering CO2, which has a lot to do with coal and is a power source, and others too. I mean, there's a CO2 residue with natural gas also, but sequestering in some of their cavities. That's a test site for that for the U.S.
Yes, it's a very interesting thing you raised there, Mr. Chairman. When you take coal, convert it to gas, sequester the carbon dioxide, sell the carbon dioxide, you can use it as a miscible injectant to enhance oil recovery. In March of last year, Oil and Gas Journal published an article on, and I'm struggling to find it right now, on this very topic. And what they discovered was, and by the way, what they were looking at is how profitable was it to have IGCC, right? That's exactly what they were saying. You know, are we going to make money on this? And the title of the article is Fisher Tropes Oil from Coal Promising as Transport Fuel, February 26, 2007. They looked at a number of scenarios where you just converted coal to oil or coal to gas. That was one option. Option two is you do that and you also generate electricity. The third is you do both of those and then you take the CO2 and you sequester it and you sell it to the oil companies and let them inject it in ground to enhance oil recovery. You use it as a miscible injectant. It turns out that if you do all three of those things, it has a rate of return at 16% with all their assumptions. And I don't remember what all their assumptions are, but it's like far higher than any of the others where you just do one of the options. And so when you think in terms of some of these technologies, not only are they proven, you know, but they actually make sense financially. And that's something I'll get into. The International Energy Agency came up with this study I got last Thursday, so I haven't read it yet, but it highlighted some areas. Fossil fuel-fired power generation. It has implications for Alaska, and so I'm trying to understand what's in here. There are a couple things I want to read to you there.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. And the committee would like to recognize Representative Olson from the Kenai. Welcome. Yep, continue.
This chart comes from the U.S. Department of Energy. Again, I selected it not because I'm endorsing the DOE's forecast, but rather it's pretty typical and it's easy to read. And I always like things that are easy to read. I found that to be very important. And this is U.S. electricity generation by fuel. And you notice we've got coal, nuclear, natural gas, renewables, and liquids. This chart starts in 1980. The most recent data is 2006. So from 2006 to 2030 is a forecast. If you look down at the very tiny print, you'll see this came out December 1st, 2007. So this is hot off the press. This is their annual energy outlook 2008. And let's just take a look at natural gas. And it's this line here, and it doesn't show up well on this chart, but you'll notice it goes up, and it actually increases. Remember I was talking about the spare capacity they had and the fact that they were still constructing plants? At some point, though, they start, according to the DOE, they start building these coal plants. Notice how coal goes up and natural gas comes down. And you'll notice how nuclear is actually plateaued and then it goes up. They actually foresee nuclear plants not closing down. It's actually a big deal if you think about it. So that the nuclear capacity remains about the same. This is their outlook. This is not mine. Again, it's pretty typical of what you're reading. Organizations that study this in great detail realize that there's a price effect, that there's competing fuels, and there's technology. You combine that together with legislation, and it has the impact to change the dynamics. Remember, that's how I started off. I want you to think in terms of trends and what's going on. It's not a static system. Everything depends on everything else. So outlook to 2015, slowing growth for gas, about 1.3% per year. Industrial sector, losing market share, electricity generating, you know, it'll grow but at a slower rate. Some of the issues to consider are supply availability, price effect, and environment. What I'd like to do now is to turn to the supply side. My overview, I'm going to go over indigenous supply by type, region, and I'll touch on drilling and cost. Then I'll go over LNG supply. I believe Senator Wilikowski asked about that. I've got a great map here. I got it off the FERC website. Talk about global supply, import terminals and tankers, and then North American supply, Canada, Mexico imports and exports. Get a sense of how all of that plays out. Indigenous supply. Just locations, Colorado Rockies, Alaska, Gulf of Mexico. I'll show you a chart that relates high prices to drilling, and I'll also tell you a little bit about higher costs in the Gulf of Mexico and how they're typical of what's going on, and then we'll talk a little bit about investment capital. So here's a nice chart. This one comes from Wood Mackenzie. Again, the reason I selected this was not because Wood Mackenzie has it right, so to say. They're pretty typical of what all the organizations are saying. This chart is relatively easy to read. On the left, we've got the volumes in millions of cubic feet per day, and we've got time on the horizontal axis. These different colors represent different resource types. Okay, this is North America. L48, that's the lower 48. CONV, that's conventional gas. That's the sort of stuff you think about. L48 shale gas, that means it comes from shale. East Coast CDN, that's Canadian, and I don't know why they did that. In their next chart, they use CAN, so they switched abbreviations. L48 tight gas. Tight gas is in rock that's about as permeable as concrete, if I remember right. I've got a definition. If you want, I'll read it. WCSB, Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, non-CBM, which is coal bed methane. Coal bed methane is associated with coal. It's in the cracks in the coal bed. Arctic Canadian, think in terms of the Mackenzie area, right up in there. U.S. lower 48 coal bed methane. And then Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin Coalbed Methane, and then Alaska, right in here. There's Alaska up there. So that's the regions they forecast. So they actually have Alaska coming on. And then if we do it, this is just a strictly regional chart. This outlines, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, San Juan, West Coast, the whole West Coast, Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin. Same volumes, but it's just presented differently. I just wanted you to see it by type as well as by region. In this country, SETI Gas says that the coal bed methane could offset declining production for conventional gas.
Senator Wilkowski.
Do you know how did Wood Mackenzie come up with the determination that Alaska gas would be online in about 2018? Do you know?
You'd have to talk to them.
Okay.
It's one of their assumptions. They believe it will come on, and I can't tell you. I do not know, but it's one of their assumptions.
And do you know how many BCF that would be per day?
I think it was yes, I do. It was in excess of 4 billion. And when you think in terms of the project that was discussed under the previous administration, it was that type of project. Now, what I want to do for a moment is focus on the Gulf of Mexico. This is the same sort of chart. And we've got production in millions of cubic feet per day. And on the horizontal axis, we've got time. And these letters, DW is deep water. And then these other letters are abbreviations. We've got different shelves. And I don't even know what they all stand for. What I do want to do, though, is read to you from a bit of the Wood Mackenzie study, because I think they've got something very interesting to say. Although the Gulf of Mexico has restored all major facility and infrastructure operations following the devastating 2005 hurricane season, production levels have fallen off significantly to approximately 8 billion cubic feet a day. Deep water projects are becoming more difficult to produce, remote, costlier, and subject to longer lead times and cost escalations. Although the Independence Hub projects and several large deepwater projects, such as Atlantis and the Thunder Horse, are projected to provide some near-term growth, longer-term supplies are expected to decline. Deepwater volumes will not stem the overall decline setting in from the mature shelf areas due to the higher day rates offered in other parts of the world. This is for the drilling rigs. They can get more for them by going over to Saudi Arabia, for example. Due to the higher day rates offered in other parts of the world, many offshore gas rigs have migrated out of the Gulf of Mexico, further exacerbating future supply declines as less exploration is conducted with longer development drilling periods as well. So there's a slowdown in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, I'm just going to talk a little bit about drilling and prices. And you'll notice this chart has both average weekly prices and average the average number of average number of drilling rigs in operation. And on the vertical, on the vertical axis, we've got on the left side, we've got the price in dollars per million BTU, the weekly price at the Henry Hub. And on the right axis, we've got the number of rigs in operation. So this is time. This is weekly data starting in January 99 and going, I think this actually goes to August, December, somewhere in there, the end of 2007. And you'll see that there was pretty much a move up as prices went up, drilling rigs went up, came down, went down, and then it went up. And now prices have fallen down, and it appears rigs have actually sort of stabilized. So the increases we've seen in the past, in the past few years, are not occurring at this point. And in part, you've heard me just read it from Wood Mackenzie, and in part it's because of the higher rates being offered in other places, and in part it's because of the higher cost of development in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah. Mr. Williams, I know we talked about this the other day, but you know, I still remain concerned. concerned after having been down to Alberta with them projecting having a shortage of natural gas to make the tar sands work, and yet the activity in exploration development of natural gas in Alberta is dormant. Layoffs was the term they used. That still concerns me. It's a little counter to what your slide shows. Any other thoughts? I mean, forget about the tax regime part of it for a moment. Just the economically, that didn't make sense to me. If they're projecting to be short of natural gas to make the tar sands work, in other words, going from 1 BCF to 4 plus, and but they've stopped activity in exploration development on natural gas. Stopped. I use the term loosely. It's been grossly reduced.
Right. Big picture, economics, right?
Right.
What other options do you have besides gas?
Right.
Are there new technologies? There's, I'm doing this from memory, there's one that's got an acronym of CHOPS. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember. It's cold something or another, heel and toe. So there's other techniques they're trying. There's also alternative fuel sources. There is coal up there, so the idea of developing energy from coal is an option. And recently they've even talked about nuclear. I think that was in the paper 2 weeks ago.
Right.
So don't think in terms of gas, think in terms of energy to develop the oil sands, right? What's your next best option?
Right. Okay, good. Thank you.
Now, this is a chart also put together by Wood Mackenzie, and we've got this is the increasing cost. So these are cost per million, or I'm sorry, per 1,000 cubic feet. And I want you to look over on the left here. So this is in dollars per 1,000 cubic feet. And then here's the cumulative production. And here's the base production that's in the Gulf of Mexico. And then these are the various plays, the various shelves. And you'll notice each one of them is separate. What Wood Mackenzie did is they built them up. Here's the cost of this one, the next one. And you'll notice how they're going up. And so what we're seeing is declining production and increasing costs in the Gulf of Mexico. And again, this is Wood Mackenzie. This is not atypical of what you'd see in other forecasts. I just used this because it was handy.
Right. What, would you point out to us the McKinsey project?
Now, this is just the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just the
this Gulf. Is just sorry, the Gulf of Mexico.
Excuse me.
This is a sort of a micro look at just one region.
Okay, I got you.
And I did it because the Gulf of Mexico represents a significant portion of natural gas production in the United States.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, this is the forecast for 2015 moved back to 07 real dollars?
Yes, real dollars.
And is there another slide or data that shows like the 07 comparison in 07, or so we get away from the, you know, a forecast out?
No.
7 years?
There's a lot of assumptions. Remember I said this is a forecast and I don't endorse all the assumptions and I don't remember all the assumptions. I probably have read them, but I just don't recall them.
Okay, thank you.
The point I'm trying to make, though, is that costs are actually increasing. That's a very big deal. I can't stress that enough. In fact, I'm going to read something from the International Energy Agency right now. General cost inflation. All construction costs have increased sharply in recent years. In part, this has resulted from higher basic material costs, such as steel and cement, but cost inflation has also been driven by a sharp increase in demand for equipment and manpower as companies have sought to respond to higher energy prices. A vicious circle has started whereby the cost of obtaining energy, raw materials, and human resources are increasing the cost of incremental supplies of the same basic factors of production. An increase in the number of large-scale projects, say that again, an increase in the number of large-scale projects being developed at the same time, their remoteness and greater complexity and the increasing need for costly production enhancement at large mature fields have added to the upward pressure on costs. I'm going to read now from the Petroleum Economist, April 2007.
Yeah, Senator Stedman has a question.
Before you go to the next article, Dr. Williams, the last one, was it referencing North America, north latitudes, or worldwide?
This is worldwide.
So was there any projections on coming attractions over the next 2, 3, 4 years?
Any projections on what?
On those cost trends over the next, the shorter time frame, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years out?
No, they just say that, no, there isn't. They just say that they're high. I always look for that. And the International Association for Energy Economics has a working paper, which I'm going to download tomorrow, which has the relation, it's the relationship of oil prices and investment in the oil and gas industry, which gets at costs.
Okay.
So I'm trying to find some, shall we say, state-of-the-art research on that. Most of the stuff I've read has big picture view, you know, what, how does investment respond just to prices, that sort of thing, long lead times. But it doesn't deal with specific areas like the Arctic or you know, what's driving costs, what's going to help them go down, those sorts of things.
Okay, thank you.
This article was in the Petroleum Economist, April 2007. Last year, no oil majors approved developments to increase LNG production, and the last final investment decision on an LNG scheme was taking 15 months on Qatar Gas 3. That's a big project in Qatar. U.S. contractor Bechtel says the cost of building LNG plants has trebled in 6 years. Trebled in 6 years. One of the industry's big three engineering, procurement, and construction contractors, along with Japan's Chiyoda and the Japanese U.S. JGC KBR Consortium, Bechtel says the cost of building liquefaction plants has risen to as much as $600 per ton a year of production capacity, up from $200 per ton per year in 2000. Two of the largest projects in the world under construction are over budget and behind schedule. Timescales are becoming longer as well. The stretched contracting market means build times for liquefaction plants are 4 years rather than three. An 18-month delay in the FID, which is, what does that stand for? I just read it to you. The final investment decision at BP led a 7.6 million ton per year Tangguh project to a cost increase from $400 million to $1.8 billion after the original contract expired. If you, quote, if you leave everything equal and just ramp up the costs and then some of the economics start to look pretty miserable, not what you expect from an LNG project, they quote someone from Wood Mackenzie, who's head of their global LNG consulting. The underlying causes of rising construction costs are escalating raw material prices and the tight contracting market, both signs that the LNG industry is becoming a victim of its own success. Until 2006, technological advances and increased economies of scale pushed liquefaction plant construction costs down, forcing them below $200 per ton. This made LNG costs more competitive when measured against alternative pipeline schemes. However, last year saw a cost edge higher to the $250 to $350 range, and Wood Mackenzie estimates prices have now risen substantially above that, between $5,000 and $1,000 per ton per year in that range. Costs, a big deal.
So your message when you read there's rapidly escalating cost of LNG facilities. Trebled.
Yeah. Remember what they're saying, it's contractors that are available to do it, it's raw materials, manpower. All of those things go into any large project. They also said the concurrent nature of the projects at the same time. Just I'm trying to give you a big overview and trend. You've got to keep in mind that prices of crude oil decreased by 50% in 1986. And one of the way a company could remain profitable was to merge, and that's when we started seeing a lot of the merging of the private, of the big oil companies. At the same time, the companies that were doing the exploration and drilling, you know, those service companies, they started downsizing as well. The number of engineers graduating with petroleum degrees decreased, and so there's a shortage of manpower. Eventually that will come around, but think in terms of the next 10 years. How long does it take for someone to go to school, get a degree, and come out? How long does it take to train them? And then think in terms of the baby boomers retiring. I mean, there's a confluence of things going on here.
Senator Wilkowski.
Is this limited strictly to natural gas, or are we seeing this also in other areas? Would the cost of nuclear have risen similarly, or the cost of coal have risen similarly? Are you able to say?
It's across the board. I think oil and gas may be feeling it more strongly because of the downsizing. The electric utility industry has not downsized. They've been expanding. So they still have a lot of electrical engineers. And while nuclear has been relatively stagnant in the United States, it has not been stagnant around the world.
Yeah. Mr. Williams, we're going to put you on cruise control here. We don't want to bring you back third time.
LNG supply global capacity is growing rapidly. U.S. imported 1.4 BCF of LNG in 2006, and the EIA predicts that will increase by 80% this year, 80%, and five times larger in 2015. They seem to be overestimating. In part, it's because of the warmer winters that we've having, and in part, it's because they're diverting the LNG cargoes over to Asia. Remember, we talked about that earlier. Here's a nice chart from Wood Mac, which shows LNG liquefaction capacity worldwide. And this greenish line is what's on stream right now. This next layer is what's under construction, and this darker bluish is what's probable, and then the possible is up there. I'm trying to go a little bit faster here. While it's going, the LNG fleet is also growing, and it's pretty amazing if you think about it. This top line is the number of tankers, right? And by the way, this runs from 1980 out to 2010, and then this down here is the liquefaction, or the number of ships. I'll start again. The black line is total capacity, and the line underneath it is ships, and you see both of them are growing rather rapidly. The contracts for them are in place. They're under construction. And that's the due dates when they're supposed to be coming online. North America, now this is Senator Wilkowski's question. Here's all the projects. I've just grouped them together. The next two pages is a map showing where they're located, and the following table actually provides details on them, the name, the capacity, and the company that's running them. MARAD, for those of you, is an acronym for the Maritime Administration. That's U.S. Department of Administration, Maritime Administration, and the Coast Guard. So I'll zip through these quickly. Here's the famous map. All the dots represent, shall we say, actual or potential locations for the LNG regasification facilities. And the ones that are lettered like this E are ones that are actually operational right now. And then the numbered ones are the ones that are proposed or probable. And here's the list. Again, I got this off the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC website, and it was updated January 14th. So you can easily stay up to date just by going to that website and you see what the status is.
Now, correct me, Mr. Wayne, if I'm wrong. What I remember projecting as far as results from all these approved projects, it will be probably single digit with some left over that will actually be built based on all the dynamics required to build and put into operation. Does that ring true with your appraisal or not?
Yes, I don't think all of the ones that are proposed are going to happen. Right. And I'm reluctant to put a share on it, but I think less than half, you know. Here's a nice graphic from Wood Mackenzie, and this just is very similar to what the U.S. Department of Energy said. Don't really think in terms of the actual numbers, but just how a number of organizations are envisioning it ramping up. I'm going to spend just a moment here on Canada and Mexico. There is a pipeline that exports about 9.1 BCF per day to the U.S. in 2005. It currently accounts for about 90% of U.S. imports. As we look forward, though, there'll be less gas available to the U.S., and that's because of decreased production and increased domestic consumption. And this is the tar sands issue. In Mexico, they've got a pipeline down there which imported from the U.S., and in the short term, there'll be some changes, but it's relatively flat. And again, if we look at this chart, here's Canada, and you'll see the WCSB, the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, is coming down. East Coast Canada is relatively flat, and again, they show Arctic Canada coming on there. So, but again, the trend is down, which means that there's less exports into the United States or less imports into the United States. And here's a chart from our favorite U.S. Department of Energy. This is last year's chart. They hadn't published the new one this year. And this shows U.S. natural gas imports. Again, very similar to what Wood Mackenzie. Canada comes down. Overseas LNG goes up, and Mexico is relatively flat. Conclusions. U.S. gas production is declining. New U.S. gas production is higher cost. Canada's role diminishes in relative importance. U.S. becomes more dependent on LNG. And if there's lower prices in natural gas, they decrease the threat from coal and nuclear. And now, to leave you with some points to ponder that aren't up there, I'd like you to remember uncertainty. There's a lot of uncertainty surrounding environmental issues. How is that going to play out? Will there be more legislation? And if there is more legislation, what will it be? Will it enhance the natural gas pipeline that we would like to see? Will it enhance coal? I don't know. The utilities are trying to get some standards. They are the ones that are actually promoting the implementation of some policy in the United States, and they want it so they can get certainty and move forward with their decision making. Will there be a nuclear renaissance? I can't answer that. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is actually gearing up to have a lot more applications, but I don't know how that's going to play out. Is IGCC feasible? Will utilities begin constructing plants? I'll read you just a little bit from this fossil fuel power generation. They studied 8 of these IGCC plants. The case studies showed that the technologies for reliable operation at high efficiency and very low conventional pollutant emissions from coal-fired power generation are available now at commercially acceptable cost. That's in the foreword on page 3. What they talk about is all of these studies are not the regular commercial applications, you know, where they, it's where they do a plant that is a demonstration project. So they haven't done the commercial-sized plants yet. There's 4 of them that are up for grabs in the U.S. right now, and that are being negotiated. And I just lost my page, so I want to try to find that. I know we're running short of time. And will the crude oil natural gas price ratio remain the same? Will it go back to historical standards? Will it get further apart? That not only affects the value of the gas, but it impacts what we collect in revenue vis-a-vis the ACES legislation where gas and oil prices are blended. Mr. Chairman, committee, I know I've taken a lot of your time today. I appreciate the opportunity to try and share with you some of what's going on in the world. If there's any other questions I can answer, I'll attempt to do that.
Okay. Questions? Mr. Williams? Well, Mr. Williams, I would, you know, on behalf of the committee, say thank you very much. Very professional presentation. I mean, I'll be candid as usual. Your brief was very informative. It leaves me concerned, though, based on the situation that I see us in. I mean, you talk about the rapid escalation of LNG coming, and I think the biggest international operator in LNG is BG, who we thought was going to bid on our operation. It didn't happen. And then we got sort of one organization left standing. And it appears the scenario that you have painted, which I don't disagree with, I think you're, at least from my perspective, probably about right, potentially, as far as you can forecast. But we don't have a very robust opportunity, it appears. I remain optimistic and a cheerleader for the pipeline. So any other good news you have, don't hesitate to call us. And thank you very much. We appreciate
certainly.
It.
My pleasure.
Yep. Thanks. And we're adjourned.